27th chapter of Matthew's Gospel. In a moment, we'll begin reading at verse 26 of Matthew 27. The cross, and obviously the resurrection following the cross, is central to Christianity. Living in 20th century America, it is hard for us to understand what crucifixion is all about because we, generally speaking, are very unfamiliar with the process of crucifixion. And on occasion, I think it behooves us and encourages us in our faith to go back and be reminded of what Jesus endured for us. We're going to do that this morning. And I've got to tell you that we're going to look at some very, very gruesome details of what is involved in the process of crucifixion. And I don't do that to linger over it needlessly, but that we might be reminded again of what He endured for you and for me, because it was our sin that put Him there. Let me begin by saying that death in those days and execution in those days differed a great deal from our day. Two primary differences in the execution in those days and the execution in our day. First, the execution in our day is very private. Very private. There are no television cameras when one is executed in the United States of America. There is no public gathering where you are free to go and to witness someone being put to death for the crimes that he has committed. In Jesus' day, just the opposite was true. It was very public. It was designed to be public. The crime was written on a board and placed above the one who was being crucified in order to say to the public, in essence, hey, you commit these crimes and this is what awaits you. The victim was executed in the most public place that they could find so that more people, the better, could see it as a way to deter those who would lift their hand in opposition to Rome. Second, execution in our day is designed to be very quick. I was reared in a state where the execution was by electric chair. And I mean after they strapped you in the chair, having shaved your head and put the electrodes on you, etc., and they throw the switch just seconds and you're dead. In some states, it's by lethal drug injection. In others, it's by gas chamber. The last I heard, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, there are some states that even execute by hanging, and even one, I believe, was even killing people or executing them by firing squad. But in every instance, the death was designed to be very, very quick. Just the opposite was true in the day of Jesus. The longer, the more torturous, the more agonizing the execution, the better, and hence crucifixion. Crucifixion had been begun by the Phoenicians. They had this god of the earth called Ormuzd. And they felt that it defiled the earth for a criminal to die on the earth and be buried in the earth. And so they devised this execution plan where one would not be in the earth or on the earth, and it was crucifixion. And so the criminal was executed up above the earth on a cross, and he was left there not only after death, but he was left there so that the beasts of the field and the birds of the air might come and literally pick him clean so that the earth would not be defiled. The Persians picked it up from the Phoenicians. The Romans perfected it. And hence we have the day of Jesus. But there were some very, very agonizing things that took place even before the execution. It begins in verse 26. The he in verse 26 is Pilate. The Bible says, then he, Pilate, released Barabbas to them. But he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The process of flogging or scourging was a process that was not normally ministered to people who were going to be crucified. Researchers have found that the punishment of scourging was so absolutely grotesque that usually it was administered by itself, separate and apart from crucifixion. And scholars believe that Jesus was scourged, Jesus was flogged by Pilate in order to create some sympathy in the crowd that was calling out, kill him, crucify him. And whenever Pilate found no sympathy in the crowd, even after scourging, then he went on and let Jesus be crucified. The flagellum is the Greek term that is used here to describe it. The flagellum was a whip that had a wooden handle on it, 14 to 18 inches long. Attached to that handle were long, heavy leather straps, and it was handed to the man called the lictor, L-I-C-T-O-R, lictor. He was a professional in torturing. That was his job. He was paid to be the lictor. And he would attach to these long, heavy leather straps pieces of lead or metal or bone, and it was designed not only to inflict pain, but literally to rip and to tear the flesh off of a man's back. I came across some research of a medical doctor. His name is Dr. C. Truman Davis, who studied much of the evidence, the historical evidence concerning the scourge and what all it involved. And I want to read to you just briefly from his account what takes place when one is scourged. A man is brought in and there is a big round stump that is about knee high. A man is completely stripped of his clothing until he is nude. There were four rings stationed on either side, four rings, two on either side of the stump, so that a man was bent over the stump, hands tied to two of the rings, legs tied to the other two. And in that position of being bent over that stump and the entire body nude and exposed, then the beating would begin. And he describes it this way. The Roman legionnaire steps forward with the flagellum in his hand. It's a short whip consisting of several heavy leather thongs with two small balls of lead attached near the ends of each thong. The heavy whip is brought down with full force again and again across Jesus' shoulders, back, and legs. At first, the thongs cut through the skin only. And then as the blows continue, they cut deeper into the subcutaneous tissue, producing first an oozing of blood from the capillaries and veins of the skin, and finally the spurting arterial bleeding from vessels in the underlying muscles. The small balls of lead first produce large, deep bruises, which are then broken open by subsequent blows. And finally, the skin of the back is hanging in long ribbons. The entire area is an unrecognizable mass of torn, bleeding tissue. When it is determined by the centurion in charge that the prisoner is near death, then the beating is stopped. I read some other sources that said that the way that they revived a man, because once the beating began, it wasn't uncommon at all for a man to pass out from the pain. And so the way they revived a man, once the scourging had begun, was to take cool salt water and pour it on his back. They used pain to revive a man in order to experience even deeper pain. They took Jesus and they tied him over the stump. And the lictor began his awesome, gruesome work. And revived again and again by the salt water on his back. They beat him until the centurion said, "That's enough." The Bible says it, verse 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. And they stripped him. I don't know how many of you have been around some military barracks in your life. Many of you have been in the military and you've been around the barracks where military personnel are. I've never been in the military, and hence I've never been around military barracks. But I've been around a lot of dormitories where men's hearts are not turned toward God. Now I want you to picture Jesus, who is absolutely stripped, nude. And a whole company of soldiers are now gathered around him. And think about what was said. The abuse, the mocks, the shame, the insult of being in that would be so embarrassing that it is hard for us even to bear to think about. The skin on his shoulders and back and legs have literally been stripped away. And now as a spectacle, they strip him completely again, and the whole company of soldiers, it says, gathered around him for the sport. This man says he's a king. What does a king need? Well, a king needs a crown, and a king needs a robe, and a king needs a scepter, and a king needs praise. Those four things, that's what we'll give him, they said. And so the text says at verse 28, they put a scarlet robe on him. The word in the Greek language is not the word robe, which was used to describe the long flowing robe that most people wore. It was the robe that was just really a shawl that draped around the shoulders and tied at the neck. You see many of our women in our day and time wearing these during the wintertime. It's just a cape that just covers the shoulders. And Jesus just had this cape draped around his shoulders and tied around his neck, and he was still nude from the chest down. And then they wove a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They used these thorns for kindling to set fires in public places. They would take these thorns. Some of these thorns were 3/4 inch long. Some of them were as long as 3 inches long. And they would take these things and dry them and put them in big receptacles or buckets around in public places so that they could use them for kindling to start fires in public places, like the one Peter warmed himself by. And so as Jesus is in this public spectacle and surrounded by soldiers, one runs out and says, "Let's give him a crown." And he grabs a strand of thorns out of the bucket and plaits a crown and thrusts it onto his head. And the Bible says, there the crown of thorns sat. C. Truman Davis goes on to say that as the thorns would have been placed in the scalp, there would have been copious bleeding because the scalp is one of the most vascular areas in all of the body. Then the text says, they put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. Or you can almost hear the laughs coming from the whole company of soldiers. "Ha, ha, ha, what a king. Hail, King of the Jews," they cried. After just a little bit, that grew old pretty quick. And so then further physical abuse took place. They spit on him. And they took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And Jesus' face would have begun to swell. The black and blue of the bruises would have begun to take their toll. And every time they struck him on the head with a staff, the crown of thorns would have been thrust deeper into the scalp and more blood would have come forth. And after they mocked him, they took off the robe. The robe now would have already begun to adhere to the wounds on his back, the blood that had clotted in the serum and the wounds. And now they tear that robe, that cape, off of his shoulders and back. It would have been like ripping off a surgical bandage. And all of a sudden, the wounds begin to flow with blood again. The pain would have been excruciating. And they put his own clothes on him, and they led him away to crucify him. There's not much said in the text about the trip from this place to Golgotha. But the trip was made as the victim or the prisoner would walk out in an imaginary square between four Roman soldiers, two to the front, right and left, and two to his rear, right and left, and the whole procession was led by the centurion who was in charge of putting this man to death. And the whole procession would have been led out through the streets. It was just to add to the shame of it all. And the climb from this place in Jerusalem out to the hill of Golgotha is quite a climb. It's called the Via Dolorosa if you go to Jerusalem today. And you walk up that thing and you're tired just walking up, let alone carrying a cross. Jesus' strength was gone. He'd been beaten almost to death. The loss of blood would have been great. The bruises, the fatigue of being up all night. His strength was gone. He didn't carry the cross the whole way. And so the text says, as they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. And they came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. And there they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. They had kind of a sedative, if you will, arranged for the victim who's going to be crucified. As he arrived at the place of crucifixion, they would give him wine mixed with gall, and it was to kind of dull his senses so that the pain wouldn't be so excruciating he might pass out again. But Jesus refused to drink the wine. Why? Because he wanted to taste the fullness of death for you and me. No sedative, no drug. I want nothing. I'm going to taste it all. I'm going to taste the fullness of death. And when they crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots, and sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. The dull routine, as Barclay calls it, of crucifixion was very methodical, very professional, and very quick. The cross beam that the victim had carried out was laid on the ground. The victim was grabbed by both arms and yanked to the ground. And when he had fallen, he was placed on top of the cross beam, and two Roman soldiers would kneel on each side of him. One would put his knees on the inside of his elbow, and the other would hold down the victim's hand with both of his hands and hold it firmly to the cross beam. Then the executioner would begin to probe about in the wrist and find that hollow place in the wrist where there was neither bone nor primary vascular artery, where there was no major artery, where there'd be tremendous bleeding. And once he found that thing, with the soldiers kneeling on his arms and holding his hands down, then the executioner would take the spike, 10 to 12 inches long, place it in the spot, and the hammer would be brought down with unbelievable force and penetrate the wrist. And there would have been a spray of blood and a cry of agony. The right wrist was always nailed first. And then two more soldiers would kneel on the left arm and the left hand, and all of a sudden the executioner would find the spot, and the nail would be driven through that spot. When the executioner was certain that the man was affixed to the cross in such a way he could not pull loose, then he gave the motion, and the four soldiers would raise up the crossbeam. And he would pick the man up literally by his wrists, and the man's feet would come up off of the ground. The crossbeam would be placed on the place, the vertical piece of wood that was already there. Then the sign would have been hung over his head. And at that point, then the most tedious work of crucifixion began. For as the man was hanging there in a V shape with his wrists, then he would nail the feet to the cross. That was the most tedious part of the work. They found if they didn't nail the feet in the proper place, that the victim would die too quickly. They always nailed the right foot over the left. One soldier grabbed one calf and hold it there with the left foot, the right foot placed over the top of it, and two more soldiers grabbed the calf of the right leg, and all of a sudden, then the executioner finds the exact spot, and the nail, 14 inches long, penetrates both feet and into the cross. It was unbelievable the pain that was associated with crucifixion. Some of the doctors' reports that I read concerning crucifixion said, here's what takes place. That as one hangs his whole body weight suspended from his wrist, that the pectoral muscles across the chest are paralyzed. And that he finds this involuntary panic beginning to fill him, because he finds himself able to draw air into his lungs, but impossible does he find it to exhale the air out of his lungs. And so he draws air in, but he cannot release it. And then there's this panic that is born. And so in order to breathe properly, he'd have to push against the nails in his feet and push himself and rub himself up against that cross and lift himself up to relieve the pressure on his arms, which would release the tension across his chest. Then he could exhale and get two or three breaths and sag again, because the pain in his feet would have been unbelievable. The doctors I read that made their report said that the man on the cross, it was in perpetual motion the whole time he was there. It was a process of pushing himself up and letting himself down, and pushing himself up and letting himself down, just so he could breathe. You see, when people died by crucifixion, they didn't die because of loss of blood. They didn't die because of starvation. They died because they found themselves exhausted to the point they could no longer push against the nails in their feet, and they suffocated. That's why they broke the legs of the thieves who were crucified next to him. With broken legs, they could no longer push against the nail in the feet, and they would suffocate, and death would come. They crucified Jesus. And it's hard for us living in this comfortable building. I'll tell you, it's hard for us to understand the absolute torture of crucifixion. One man I read this past week said that the combination of thirst and pain and shame and insects and the panic of rigid fixation all combined to make crucifixion the supreme torturous death. Two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on his left. And those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you're the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said. "He can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross. Then we'll believe him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And in the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over the whole land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one ran and got a sponge and filled it with wine vinegar and put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. But the rest said, "Leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. And at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rock split. Even the creation that he called into being revolted as the Son of God is put to death. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. And they came out of the tomb, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. And when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, surely he was the Son of God. Countless thousands have meditated on and thought on the death of Jesus. And some even wrote about it, one of which was named Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard wrote some of the most beautiful, poetic pictures of Jesus' agony at the cross that have ever been put to music. It was put to a melody by Bach. We're going to sing it in just a moment, but first I'd like to read it. O sacred head, now wounded, with grief and shame weighed down, now scornfully surrounded with thorns, thine only crown. How art thou pale with anguish, with sore abuse and scorn? How does that visage languish, which once was bright as morn? What language shall I borrow to thank thee, dearest friend, for this thy dying sorrow, thy pity without end? Oh, make me thine forever, and should I fainting be, Lord, let me never, never outlive my love to thee. The story of the crucifixion has always moved me from the time that I was young enough to remember. And now, many years removed from that first time I heard the story, it never ceases to touch me. It brings about in me a new commitment every time, to never take lightly what God has done in my behalf. As the Hebrew writer put it, in light of what we've seen and heard and experienced because of Jesus Christ, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? I hope this morning you've been renewed in your commitment to Jesus Christ. It may be today that this is the first time that you've really heard in detail the story of what Jesus endured for you, that you've never really made a commitment to Jesus Christ to receive the forgiveness of sin. It may be that you don't really know what all is required of you or what God wants you to do, but you know after having heard the story, you need to do something about it. We'd invite you to come this morning. Let us share with you what God wants you to do. It may be that you've heard and heard, but never reacted, never responded, never made that commitment. This morning would be a time for you to come and say, I'm not neglecting anymore the salvation that's been provided for me. Whatever your response to Jesus' invitation, we'd encourage you to come this morning. Be united with Him. Would you come as we stand together and sing? tonight for a few minutes for the benefit of the body here at Quail Springs. As you know, we have invited Preston Shepherd to be a part of our staff and our work here at Quail Springs, and he is going to work specifically in the area of outreach. And in order for you to know from whence he's coming and what the direction of his ministry is going to take, and maybe answer some of the questions that you have, we're going to take a few minutes tonight, and I'm going to have Preston sit here, and I'm going to sit here, and we're going to, Merv Griffin style, maybe, I'm going to interview Preston and ask him some questions that I sat down and wrote out in hopes that you might find some answers to your question and at the same time find some general direction for Preston's outreach, the direction and goals of his ministry and what he sees in line for us at Quail Springs. Preston, I'd like to begin by just asking you to tell us a little bit about your previous life religiously, how you grew up and your contact with the church, etc.
Okay. I guess in a way I feel like I've gone through a whole gamut of different experiences. I was brought up in a denominational church up until about the third grade. My parents became dissatisfied that they weren't really learning too much Bible and wanted to go around. All I was doing in my classes as a small child was just sort of coloring books and not learning anything. So we started visiting a lot of different places, and it was through my sister who visited with a friend the Church of Christ that my parents began to attend. And it wasn't too much time had passed before both my parents were baptized into Christ. My father was 56 years of age at the time, and my mother was 14 years younger, so she'd been 44. And my sister was also baptized, that was in high school at the time. And I grew up in an environment that I soon learned, I think, a lot of Bible. We were very involved in Bible classes and that type of thing. But I guess I lived a very typical, I guess, teenage life in the sense that, I guess maybe for down where I was at, that we talked a lot about doing a lot of things, but I guess I would say a lot of neat things, but I never really got personally involved. And I graduated from high school, went off to school in Lubbock, Texas. And I guess the first 2 years I was in school, I really just took a vacation. Oh, a good friend of mine used to get up, and the first devotional he'd ever do is to warn the students not to take a four-year pass. You know, because oftentimes when you get off to the state school, you want to just sort of lay it all aside and sort of identify with it. And I did that. I took a two-year pass from church and really just sort of wanted to see what it was like. And I would come to church every once in a while, and if I was to come here, I'd have probably sat way in the back, and as soon as the final amen was out, I was out the doors, and that made me sort of feel good. It sort of satisfied my conscience that I attended every once in a while, but as far as being involved, I really wasn't. It was about my junior year of school that I just went through a breakup with my high school girlfriend. We were engaged, and we broke up, and I was just all torn up, and a good friend of mine said, "Why don't you go down to the student center and see what can happen down there?" And I did, and it wasn't but just the first time there that I really had a change. It was sort of a different experience because I went to a devotional, and I went to a group. It was just college students, and I sat in there, and I guess for the first time in my Christian life, I really experienced something that I guess I'd always studied about or read about. And I saw these college students really acting out a love for each other. It really freaked me out or weirded me out at first because I'd see these guys and they'd sing and they'd be arm in arm a lot of times singing songs. And when they'd greet each other a lot of times, instead of a healthy handshake or something, sometimes they'd even hug each other. And I was going, man, you know, I'm just not used to that kind of stuff. But it wasn't too long before I saw that their love was real genuine for each other. And that was really where I wanted to invest my time. And so I became pretty involved in the campus work and sort of follow along on the coattails of a couple of guys that were real involved. And I guess it just sort of gradually got me going that way. I graduated from Texas Tech in 77 with a finance degree. I think the same thing you got there. And so I guess I always told people we had to have a finance degree to learn how to raise support. But it comes in real handy sometimes. But after I graduated from Texas Tech, I went to work for Texas Instruments for about 3 years. And I still remain very, very active in the college program, coming back and leading Bible studies in the dormitories. And We even got, you know, a couple things started out there at TI, and that was a lot of fun. And then I guess about 1980, I decided I wanted to go in to make it a full-time thing. I was really frustrated that I had to sort of serve TI about 10, 12 hours a day sometimes, and that I wanted to be up on campus seeing people and that type of thing in my outreach. So I just gave them notice and said, I'm gonna go do this full-time. And I didn't know anything about it, so I just went around and asked people if they'd help me in that, and we got together a team and moved up to the state of Washington to start a campus ministry from scratch. About 12 of us left Lubbock, Texas to do that. And I've been up there from 1980 to just about a month ago as the campus minister in Bellingham, Washington.
You mentioned that one of the things that you were involved in the last 2 years that you were in Tech, as well as at Texas Instruments when you were working there, you mentioned the term Bible studies. And after having talked to you some, you might explain to us what you mean by Bible studies when you say that.
I was real fortunate, I guess, at Lubbock to be involved with it as they were first starting to formulate. So we went through a lot of changes, and I guess I've seen it work a lot of different ways. And still, I guess, I feel like I'm experimenting all the time and finding out what's the best tool as far as reaching out to the non-Christian, reaching out to make the gospel, or to really bring the gospel into their lives. But basically all we did was we just went around the dorms and we'd go around meeting people. I lived in the dorm for a year, but I never was involved in the type of Bible study. That was my first year. So this was when I was living off of campus. I'd come back and we'd just go visiting around the dorms, and we'd just sort of knock on a few doors and say, yeah, we're just out visiting people and like to meet you, and we'd like to tell you about a Bible study we're having down in room 201 or something like that. And we'd get a lot of people coming. We had, at times, we'd have 20 people in one of these little dinky dorm rooms. I mean, they're really small. And it'd be really exciting. And during those 2 years, we just through the campus work there, there'd be 40, 50, sometimes 60 baptized into Christ through the campus work at Texas Tech. And we got Bible studies started in just about every single dormitory. And that was a real thrill. It was, I guess, I was trying to really support that Bible study and bringing visitors to it. And most of the people that I knew, of course, weren't in the dormitories because most people I knew were at Texas Instruments. So what I'd do is I'd invite some of my younger friends at TI to come to a Bible study in the dorm. And we reached one of these guys, and he came, and he became a Christian, and now just a super close brother. But back at TI, he said, boy, Preston, why don't we get something like that going at TI? And I said, man, you know, that's a different ballgame. You know, I mean, I was really nervous about that. But just his enthusiasm as a new Christian, I went with it. And so together we started a Bible study at Texas Instruments. We did it at 6:30 on Friday mornings, about an hour and a half before most of the guys had to start work. And we'd do it in the cafeteria, and we'd have up to four or five visitors, non-Christians, come every single time. Up to 14 one time. That was really neat. But through that study, there was about four baptized into Christ, and three of those were guys that left their jobs at TI to go up with me to Washington. And they just sort of uprooted themselves, and they wanted to get involved in missions. They wanted to be involved in something exciting for the church. They left their jobs that were paying $9, $10 an hour to go up to Washington to just support the work in a vocational way. And they had to take jobs because Bellingham wasn't a situation that they could get jobs in electronics literally for minimum wage. One guy worked on TVs, another guy worked at Radio Shack, another guy was, I forgot what he was involved in, but you know, it really impressed me that those guys were willing to do that, and it sort of shows you the life impacting that it has when people really get involved and come to the Lord through that.
When you refer to Bible studies, you're referring to a group of, say, a handful of Christians, one of which is going to be the group leader. Right. And they go out in turn and invite non-Christians to come and be a part of a Bible study on a given night or a given morning at a certain time. And then they come and y'all sit down and the leader leads the discussion and the study. And after having studied and get to know and build relationships with those people, then you talk to them one-on-one to convert them to Christ. Is that
right?
The gist of what you're saying?
The Bible study itself is just sort of an agent to introduce yourselves and to really bring the gospel into their lives. It's an agent to try to familiarize yourself with the people there, and so in hopes that you might be able to study one-on-one. And it's usually very natural for the person after they come for a while, they want to learn more. And it's a very natural response. As a matter of fact, they're sort of waiting for you to ask them, because oftentimes they'll have a lot of questions. I didn't understand what we studied tonight, or can you go through with me more? And all, nine times out of ten, they might even bring it up as far as, can you explain this? And naturally I'd say, man, I'd love to. Why don't we go back to your room, or why don't we, make a donut appointment, meet at the donut shop, and let's just talk about it there, or anything like that. So it's really neat. The neat thing about it is it's a teamwork deal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really put the pressure upon just one person. For instance, like going out and knocking doors and coming up with cold contacts, that a way to try to reach the city or the campus or whatever, wherever you're working. It's a type of deal where you want to bring your friends into a situation to meet other friends of yours. Usually you work five or six maybe Christians in a study, and you'll all just work on bringing your friends. And you really get the teamwork feeling going, where you're doing it together. It might be that one of my best friends that I might bring to the study might hit it off just tremendously with someone else in the study. And they may, go off and just start doing things together. They might, their hobbies might just tie together beautifully. It might be that I might not lead that person to Christ. Someone else in the study would, because they hit it off so much better.
Is it not true that your wife, Sandy, was converted through one of these studies? Right. You might tell me a little bit about that and the anticipation she had that somebody was going to talk to her and didn't for a while.
Yeah, that's a really thing that I'm so thankful for about these studies. I met my wife through the campus ministry at Texas Tech, and she was a visitor to one of these type of Bible studies. Literally, some girls would come by and invite her to come to one of these Bible studies, and she got to come in for over a year, on and off. Sometimes, she wasn't real regular, but during the course of a year, she would come to these, learn a lot of different stories about the Bible and different situations and things that we need to know. But they also invited her to a lot of other things. They brought her to church several times, and she got to meet a lot of people. And that was really how she was introduced to the fellowship at large, is because she came to a smaller study. And that way, she felt like she knew several people that went to church. Oftentimes, people are afraid to come to a larger church just because, I don't know anybody. But if you know several people that are also going, then it makes it much more comfortable for them. And I think that's sort of the way Sandy was. She came, and we started dating. And it was about a month or two after that that I had the privilege of baptizing her into Christ. And so I'm real thankful for that type of outreach, bringing her into my life.
I guess that all of us, I remember when I became a Christian, all of us are a little bit afraid and intimidated by the word evangelism and what all that means. When I first became a Christian, the thought of going to somebody to try to win them to Jesus Christ was something that scared me. And I think it scares most of us. But a tool like this, where you're inviting someone to come to be a part of a Bible study, does not seem to be all that threatening to me. It would be easy for me to invite someone to come to a group study where several people are going to be studying away from the church building. It'd be easier and non-threatening, it seems to me, to do that and to have that approach rather than all of a sudden the pressure is on me that I'm going to sit down one-on-one and try to win somebody to Christ. Have you found that to be true in the people you work
that's
with?
That's exactly true. I guess I've always said the one thing that Christians and non-Christians have in common about evangelism is they're both totally nervous about it. And you hate to put them on the defensive, and in that situation, oftentimes, you never really get down to the felt needs that a person might have. That's exactly true. When you invite them to a situation in which it's sort of neutral ground in a sense, like at TI, for instance, man, when I invited guys to come to a study at TI, they felt at home there, and they felt very natural to come to a situation. Everything around them was non-threatening. They had an opportunity to meet several of the Christians, and it was a very natural thing after a matter of weeks to invite them to church with me, because I'd say, hey, I'd like for you to meet some other friends of mine that can't make it to something like this, and I think you'll really get to like them. And so it is something that's a very natural way of bringing people to Christ in a non-threatening manner, something that they are comfortable with, and something that is just a matter of just sharing in a group situation. Once again, I'd emphasize the teamwork type of thing. It's good.
I guess another thing that I kind of grew up early after my conversion to believe is that doing the work of an evangelist or trying to share your faith one-on-one with somebody is something that you're just born with. Is this something that someone can learn by going to some of these group studies and seeing how the team concept works and how others do it? Is this something that we can learn, and that as a body we can develop this consciousness of wanting to bring others that we know outside the body of Christ into Christ?
Right. I really think back to some of my friends that knew me in high school, and I tell you what, if I saw some of them in the audience, I'd probably just faint, and I'm sure they would too, to see me in a situation like this, because it's something that for me to even consider myself, you know, part of a ministry staff, it just sort of blows my mind. It's something that I really didn't even want to be a part of for such a long part of my life. It wasn't that I had aspirations to be in this type of work at all. But it's something that I guess as I got more involved in it, and it was a, sort of a slow process, I guess, at first. But when I was a part of a group that was a part of leading someone else to Christ, and especially when I saw the life transformation they went through, all of a sudden it just sparked in me that, man, this is where it's at. You know, this is fun and neat, and the guy, I really appreciate it. I think back to Kenny Jacobs, is a really good brother of mine. He trained for campus ministry. He's now a campus minister in Portland. But when I reached him, or when the Lord, opened up some doors and we were able to reach him for the Lord, he had hair down to here, and he was all in dope and all kinds of stuff. He was a guy that you look at him, you'd think, man, that guy's just not open, or wouldn't be open at all to the gospel. But to see the change and the transformation that's occurred in his life, and the appreciation that he feels, and the love that he has for you, it just makes it so a worthwhile experience. But to be a part of a group, I guess everybody that was a part of that group that where he responded and wanted to become a Christian, everybody felt a part of leading him to Christ. Because, we all had a chance to meet him and help him feel comfortable. And it was a slow thing for all of us to become more and more interested as we saw results in it.
Last Friday night, you began the first evangelistic group study here, as far as our body is concerned. And I understand that it took place at Jim and Norma Freeman's house. How did that go, and what was the results of your first study?
I think it went super. I was just really excited about it. And I think the Freemans and everybody that was there was ecstatic. We started off with about four couples, I guess, and one other single person, as sort of a core group of people that, we wanted to commit to meeting every Friday night and to reaching out and to bringing our friends to it. But we started off with sort of a potluck supper. Usually that's something that people love to come to, and they'll love to come and eat with you. And it's very natural for me to invite my friends to come and eat supper. And you'll really be surprised how much you can get to know a person just by eating with them. So usually we'd like to do that, and we had a great supper. Freeman's went with it the first time, and from here on out, everybody's going to bring a dish, and we're just going to throw it together every single time we come together. And then after that, we have a study together for about an hour. As a matter of fact, we sort of make a sort of iron-fast rule to limit it to an hour, because sometimes your friends might be a little bit hesitant to come into something like that, but they'd like to know when they can leave. And I would hate to go to something thinking it was going to be, 30 minutes or an hour, and then find out I was going to be there for 3 or 4 hours, And so it's better just to limit it, and they like that. But the success of it, we had, 16, 17 people there, something like that. We had three couples that are really wanting to investigate more about the church, more about Christianity, and I was just really excited about that. And as far as I know, I think they're all planning to come back, and we're planning to go at it again next week.
Outstanding. That's super. Could you share with us maybe what we can do as a family to show support to you to help get involved in these evangelistic group studies? What do you want from us? What can we do to help and support in order to become the evangelistic church that we think that God would have us be here?
I've already felt so encouraged, I guess, just being here. I'm 100% sure that my choice to come here to Quail Springs was the right choice. And you've already done so much. It's neat that so many people have come to me and said, I'm really ready to get, something going with you. And I just really appreciate all of y'all for the chance you're giving me, I guess, in a sense, to try to bring a spark of this type of thing. What we're going to try to plan, and briefly mentioned with talked with the elders about it today, and we'll be talking about it more in the weeks to come, is to literally start thinking about Oklahoma City as a mission field in itself. You know, and that's something I think that is very healthy for us. I think back to Acts chapter 1, about verse 8 or something, or somewhere around there, where Jesus addresses the mission of the apostles. You know, and he says, you know, I want you to take this message to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. And he really emphasizes there at home first. And that's something I think that as we work at here at home, it's going to naturally spread through all the world. As a matter of fact, I think as we build a stronger evangelistic base here in town, we're going to see that we're going to have people rising up all the time. That's been my experience with it, literally, just like those guys at TI. They want to go to other parts of the world, and that's what I'm excited about. We're planning to introduce, and you know, I think this is sort of a dream. I like Martin Luther King's expression is that I have a dream, and I've got a dream that literally will have Bible studies in every single block throughout Oklahoma City. And I imagine we have people that live in parts, all parts of Oklahoma City, that we can really reach out to a lot of folks. Literally, I have a dream that we can begin in the fall with maybe 23 group Bible studies. And you might say, man, that's, you know, nobody's worked with it. Nobody, or I really don't know. I've really been surprised to find out that there are quite a few people that have worked with this and encouraged that the Browns over here were reached through a Bible study in Colorado through the same thing. And so they're used to it, and I'm sure that a lot of you are. But what I'd like to do in the next 6 to 8 weeks is just sort of start meeting with people that would be interested in training just on the group dynamics aspect of it, and training the leadership of it, and where we can introduce that many different Bible studies throughout the city. And I really think in a matter of a year or 2 years that could literally grow. That's my dream, is that it could literally grow to 100 to 200 Bible studies throughout this whole city.
Well, that's certainly been the case of some other congregations in our fellowship. I know that the Boston Church and the Boston Church of Christ has 150 Bible studies going each week. They study with between 300 and 500 non-Christians every week. Sure. Baptized over 400 last year and are going to baptize over 500 this year, Lord willing. And I'm grateful for your dream and for your vision, and I think for the spark that you're going to bring to this family evangelistically.
That's a dream I think that we all share. You know, I think every one of us wants to reach this city for Christ, and it's a dream that I know that with your enthusiasm that you've already given me, and just working together, that teamwork effect, I'm sure that we'll accomplish it.
Amen. Appreciate you, Preston. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll get James to... them, please, to Matthew 27. The 27th chapter of Matthew's Gospel. And in a moment, we'll begin reading at verse 26 of Matthew 27. The cross, and obviously the resurrection following the cross, is central to Christianity. Living in 20th century America, it is hard for us to understand what crucifixion is all about because we, generally speaking, are very unfamiliar with the process of crucifixion. And on occasion, I think it behooves us and encourages us in our faith to go back and be reminded of what Jesus endured for us. We're going to do that this morning. And I've got to tell you that we're going to look at some